much. I'd like to introduce Herb from Midland, Texas.
Hi, everyone. My name is Herb, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Herb.
And James doesn't do himself justice. He's been the best host I've ever had anywhere, and very typical, I'm told, of this wonderful Georgia hospitality. And I certainly do appreciate it, and I thank the committee for all the kindnesses and the beautiful gift in my room. I thought it was a vase with a lot of holes in it, and then I was told, no, it's a candle holder. And it's a beautiful handcrafted cup. You know, when Sonny talked about wearing extra shorts up here, I was reminded of a sign I saw at a AA clubhouse in Neosho, Missouri a couple of years ago. It said, doing a good job around here is like wetting your pants in a dark suit. It gives you a warm feeling all over, but nobody seems to notice. Anyway, I've been, I drank for about 30 years, and I've been sober for almost that long, so I'll try to cover that 60 years in a couple hours or so. Seriously, God has blessed me with an awful lot of sobriety. When I first came in and washed up on the beach of AA in Dallas, Texas, I was pushing 45 years old, and some of the old-timers told me what a great life I had ahead of me, and I said, who cares? Who never wanted to be over 50 years old anyway. And if God continues to bless me with a daily reprieve for one more month, I will have that pleasure of celebrating 30 years of sobriety in this fellowship. Thank you. You all know that that's a blessing. It's certainly not an accomplishment. And through 29 of those 30 years, I've shared it with a young lady I met and married when she had 8 months sobriety, and she's right there with me, and that's my lovely wife, Mary Ellen. Would you stand up, honey? Thank you. She may not go home with me after I've done that, but she's an integral part of the sobriety that I will talk about tonight. I was born in Texas, and my dad was in the oil business, and mother said we chased wildcats all over the country, and when I was a baby, we moved to Los Angeles, and I started school out there. And about that time, my mother's younger sister passed away in Texas, and they came back to Texas for the funeral and found that my mother's sister had a young niece, or a daughter that was a niece to us, and she was about my age at that time, about 5 years old, and her father was a pretty bad drunk. And they must have had a quick meeting and decided, we can't leave that pretty little sweet girl here with a drunk because he can't take care of her. And they must have talked with him and assured him that if he let them bring her back to California and raise her along with me, that she would always be his daughter and always available to him. And that's the way it worked. And that when they brought Patsy home, that was the first ego disorder that cropped up in my life. I'd been an only child for about 5 years. And she was cute as hell and precocious, and I had competition then for the rest of my upbringing. And sadly, Patsy died when she was 22 years old of spinal cancer, and she did leave a little boy who's now living, he's a lawyer in Florida. And for a long time, I never knew what happened to that little boy until he reappeared in my life just a couple of years ago, and he called me. And through a God coincidence, we discovered each other, and when I talked, I said, Bobby, forgive me, but I can't think of you any other way than as a tow-headed little kid in short pants. He said, Uncle Herb, I'm 55 years old. So there have been a lot of blessings in that sense, and I was raised in a very functional home, unlike many of you, parents and kids and grandmother and church. And good schooling. My mother had been a school teacher, and so I didn't have any of those reasons genetically to look back and try to explain my alcoholism. I just earned my way in here. I kept on drinking until it happened. Probably happened after the first drink, but I didn't know it then. But I was raised, as I say, by my parents, mostly in Dallas, and I had some ability on the football field, And my parents made it clear that I could play football as long as I had an A average. If my grades dropped below an A, then I'd have to hang up the jock, as they said. And so I had the pleasure of playing on championship teams with a Heisman Trophy winner later named Doak Walker. And Doak was captain, and I played guard and ran interference for him during high school. And then when he went on up to SMU there in Dallas, I just followed him up there and played football at SMU, and we won the championship twice. And as I was approaching a degree, my dad was dying of cancer. I didn't realize it, that it was so close then, but I talked to him and said, "Dad, I don't know what I want to be. They want a degree plan." And he said, "Well, since you started school in California, you're going to graduate at 20, and that's really too young to be of much use to anyone. I would suggest more education. And in that regard, you might consider law school." He said, "All my life I've paid too damn much money for guys that didn't know any more than I did to do work I was perfectly capable of doing. So tonight I stand before you a lawyer." That was my career plan right then. And so I went on through SMU and got my business degree and then my law degree. As they said, I was educated beyond my intelligence pretty quickly. Went to work for an oil company because an oil company paid twice as much as the law firms did, and had wanderlust. I had been too young for World War II, so I kind of wanted to see the world. And working for this oil company, I'd gotten to Midland, Texas. I was assigned out there, and I woke up one day and I had over $1,000 in the bank and no meaningful relationships, as Sonny put it. My mother was very healthy and comfortable as a widow. So I thought, well, now's the time. So I quit my job and went to work my way around the world. And I had worked my way back from Spain a couple of summers before. In fact, I might take just a moment. I think this is part of the forerunner of my alcoholism. My junior year in law school, through some family friends, I was invited to go home and spend the summer with a very wealthy family in Barcelona. And I already spoke some Spanish, so it was a good thing because they spoke no English. But it was a wonderful summer, and they assigned to me my own private butler when I arrived. And Juan was my butler all summer long, and he would wait up for us when Victor, my friend, and I would go out for the evening. We might come in at midnight or 1 a.m. or whatever, but Juan would be waiting, take my clothes, and then by the time I woke up the next morning, they had been washed and pressed. And, you know, that kind of beginning in life, reality was too much for me when I came home. So I often think, well, maybe that was it. But during that time, I had started drinking. I really worked at learning to drink and smoke when I was about 15 years old and didn't really care for either one of them, but I was determined. I thought you had to do that to be mature. And I wanted to be thought to be older than I really was because I was the baby of the class. And I worked at it until it bit me. I think the Chinese have an old proverb that say, the man takes a drink, the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes the man. And then I later heard in rehab that the chains of addiction are too soft to be felt until they're too strong to be broken. And luckily, because of my athletics, we never drank or smoked during season, so that postponed perhaps the inevitable. But then after I got out, I mentioned going ahead and going to work, and then I worked my way around the world, got a job on a sailboat and left from Newport Beach for Tahiti, which was any man's dream in those days, and spent about a year on the sailboat, jumped ship in New Zealand, worked in New Zealand, Australia, came back through Europe, and then back, and I wrote to ARCO, the company I'd worked for, and said, "I'll be back broke, unemployed, and go anywhere." And when I got to Dallas, why, they sent me right back to Midland, Texas. So there seemed to be a natural magnet that drew me back there. And in those days, single guys had a lot of fun. We did an awful lot of drinking, and we'd go skiing up at Santa Fe, and we'd go rafting down in the Big Bend country. And I dated a girl who one day said, "I'm pregnant." And my first thought was, I wonder how that happened. You're way ahead of me. Anyway, we got married, and the marriage got off on an unfortunate footing basis, and we stayed married for about 12 years, and we had four children. We moved from Midland to Dallas to Los Angeles. back to Dallas, and then I went to New York and Merrill Lynch for training. And by then, I was a daily drinker. And the more I drank, the worse the marriage got. And the worse the marriage got, the more I drank. And so after about 12 years, one day we were sitting at home with the four children having a dinner, and a process server knocked at the door, and he served me with a restraining order to get out of the house, and it was divorce papers. And although I was not happy in the marriage, I was shocked and stunned. I was angered. I was hurt. I was all those negative emotions. And I marched into the hall closet, and I got my bow and arrow and my bowling ball and golf clubs, the things any drunk would need in this world. And I walked out the door, and little did I know that I would not see those people, or they would not see me, for over 2 years after that. But I was on the downward spiral by then. I was working for Merrill Lynch and drinking every day. I'd sometimes in the morning catch the bus to town, and I'd get off at the first little shopping center, walk down and buy a bottle of wine, and go around back and drink that bottle of wine in the alley, throw it in the dumpster, and catch the very next bus and hardly miss a beat to get to work on time. It never escaped notice of those people in that office. Every time Mr. Wales went to the men's room, he took his briefcase with him. Yeah, you know what that was. I had that inevitable half pint or pint of vodka. And I couldn't survive without it. And so about the time of the divorce, or at least the filing of it, my boss at Merrill Lynch called me in, and he said, "Herb, I've tried to work with you, and we can't have a drunk broker on the floor. You're going to have to leave. I'm going to have to fire you." And I said, "Well, Dick, at least give me the dignity of being able to resign." He said, "No, because if I resign, you won't get unemployment compensation, and with four children, you're going to need it." So he did fire me, and I was by then seeking lower companions. And I moved in with a friend, and I just wanted to crash there for a while. You know, drunks that live on the street, they really don't have an address. You ask a drunk, "Where you live?" "Well, I'm staying with old Pete over there, or I'm staying over here." And that's because you never know how long it's going to last. And by then, I was about 40 years old, and I was out of a work and a career. I was full of shame. I was constantly getting in trouble with the police. And I'd get picked up on the damnedest silly charges, and I'd be taken downtown, and to my horror, there'd be a bench warrant for no child support and other aggravations. So they'd put us on a chain. Those Monday mornings were awful. They'd put six of us on a chain. We'd have these orange coveralls on with CJ for county jail, and they'd take us up the elevator to the top floor to the court for arraignment. And I was a member of the Dallas Bar Association. So I'd get on that damned elevator, you know, we're all cuffed on the chain, and some lawyer'd get on his briefcase. "Herb, is that you?" I'd be looking over in the corner. And it's wonderful that we can laugh about it now, because, you know, it was horrible. The complete shredding of any self-respect was gone. I talked a few of those lawyer friends when I'd get thrown in jail to signing on my bond so I could get out. But then I would fail to show up for the arraignment. And then the bailiff would call the lawyer on the bond. So the word got around very quickly, "Don't sign Herb's bond, because he'll skip out on you." And all in all, for the next couple of years, I was 17 times in and out of jail. I kept thinking, "I need to get out of Dallas County. I'll go back to Tahiti, where I was appreciated." Now, it's funny now, but I really had those kind of insane thoughts, that I'd just go back somewhere. In fact, I even considered kidnapping some of my own boys, you know, a couple of little boys, and taking them with me. Show her, by God. And so the shame and degradation, I couldn't get out of Dallas County. I had no money. I had no way of making a living. There was one good Irish friend, Mike Carr, that owned a beer joint there called The Quiet Man. And Mike let me tend bar there for $1 an hour. And then I moved in with a couple of guys that were dope dealers, and mainly marijuana, small-time stuff. They used to let me manicure that stuff until I got to shaking so bad, and they wouldn't let me touch it anymore. They afraid I'd spill too much. But that's where my life had gone. And they say that alcoholism will take you to the bottom. It's like an elevator going down. You can push that button at any floor and stop and get off. And it takes just enough humility to ask for help. But so many of us don't have that. And we ride it all the way to the bottom, and it will take every shred of self-respect, everything you have. And that's where I went. And I was living there in Dallas and hiding because I had those four kids, and it seemed like there was a birthday coming up all the time, and I couldn't send a birthday card to that particular child because I hadn't sent one to the others before. And it was a squirrel cage, and it seemed like months went by, weeks, and then years. And I never dreamed that I could live a sober life. And finally, I was caught hiding a half a pint of vodka from my two roommates that let me move in with them. It was a ramshackle house with broken windows. In the wintertime, animals would crawl in through those windows and curl up beside us. It was that kind of a house. But they caught me with that vodka, and they threw me out and told me, "You're a broken-down old alcoholic. We've shared with you, and you're not sharing with us." I broke the code. And so they told me to leave. And I called a man who had been in AA for about 4 years. It seemed forever to me. A guy named Bob W. And I'd call Bob, and I said, "Bob, I'm in really bad trouble." He said, "Well, you have been for quite a while. What's new?" And I said, "But I don't have anywhere to go." He said, "Well, why don't we take you over to your mother's?" I said, "Well, I can't go there. She hadn't heard from me in a couple of years. She probably thinks I'm dead in the gutter somewhere." He said, "No, I've kind of kept her up with your progress. She knows you're still alive." So we went over, and of course, it was more than embarrassing. It was horrifying for me to face my mother at, as I say, almost 45 years old. And she agreed that I could move in with her on three conditions. Of course, no drugs or alcohol in the house. And she said, "You can't have my car keys. I'm sure you don't have a driver's license," which is true. I'd hit a Dallas cop and lost my driver's license for 5 years. And she said, "And no cash money." I understand giving cash to a practicing alcoholic is like giving whole blood to a vampire. So now, occasionally she would relent and give me the 55 cents, which was bus fare up to the Preston group for AA. She insisted I go to AA, and there were several men that took me on as self-appointed sponsors, and they started taking me to AA meetings. And man, I didn't know there were so many meetings. I never forget, David A. was one. Maybe you've heard of David Aronofsky. David A. called me the second night, and he said, "Herbert, get rest, and I'll pick you up in about 30 minutes. I said, "Where are we going, David?" He said, "We're going to an AA meeting." I said, "We've already done that. We did that last night. You mean they've got another meeting?" You know, there's a world of ignorance and misinformation out there. And so people like that just had me coming back because I had nowhere else to go. I became kind of a junkie hanging out in the AA clubs that were open all day long. And finally, one of the young ladies that was sobering up about the same time said, "Herb, we found a job we think you can handle." And it was pushing doorbells going through neighborhoods with a research interview. And the damn thing was about 4 pages long. It was market research, and it'd be Fruit of the Loom underwear or VO5 Alberta, something like that. And you had to get these things filled out. Paid $1.68 an hour, which was minimum wage in 1975. And I said, "Well, but hell, I haven't got a car. I can't get out there." She says, "No, we're going to take you. We've got your transportation." I guess they decided I'd been around the club long enough. An example how they reached that conclusion. One of my sponsors, self-appointed old Pete, came in one morning. He said, "Wales, we've got to get you started on these 12 steps. Well, I'd been in theater work, and I was a quick learner, so I had memorized the steps and the traditions to be ready for a pop quiz in case I had one. And I said, "Well, Pete, I've already taken those steps." He said, "When did you do that?" I said, "This morning." And I told him I'd memorized them, and he said, "Well, that's not exactly what we're talking about here." And I had a horrible attitude and resentment, you know. God, I carried that briefcase every day to the club. And old David Aronofsky said, "Herbert," and this is after I've been sober a while, he says, "You know, you were clinging to that like it was State Department papers or something. One time when you went to the men's room, I snuck a peek in there, and all you had was yesterday's newspaper and an old peanut butter sandwich." And that was the thing. And my attitude, as you well know, if you're not a willing candidate, you're not going to learn anything. And that was my problem. I was given the gift of sobriety on April the 6th, and that was my first dry date. And the compulsion was removed, just as the big book says. And it was surprisingly quick, it seemed to me. But what came back first was my anger, my jealousy, my self-pity, all the negative attitudes. And, you know, there's a quote by Herbert Spencer toward the back of the big book. It says, "There is a principle which is a bar to all information, proof against all argument, and guaranteed to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation." And that was me. I had contempt for AA. What can these dummies show me? Or what do they need from me? Maybe they need to have me in here for something. I had the wrong attitude. I didn't work the steps as it was recommended. And by midsummer, I started playing in bridge tournaments, which had been a hobby of mine, instead of going to meetings. And not surprising to any of you, by August, I'm smoking a little dope, drinking a little light, sparkling rosé, because it seemed so innocent, it shouldn't count. And anyway, I was on that spiral, and I was textbooked, and then I was angry because all of you were right and I was wrong, and I could hardly live with that. But I'd made an appointment to take one of my children fishing. Pete had told me, he said, "Herb, you've got to call those children right here in this same town. If you don't, you're going to run into them one day on the street, and they'll be horrified to find out you're alive." And so with his nudging and help and encouragement, I did call him and make an appointment to take my fishing son fishing. I said, "Pete, I don't believe I can do it without taking a drink." He said, "No, you've got to show up sober after this period of time." He said, "Just don't bait any hooks. If you do, you bleed to death." And as I remember, my son, he caught several fish that weekend. I didn't, but that was the beginning of trying to get back into some sort of mainstream of life. And I was ringing those doorbells and hoping I wouldn't be recognized, making $1.68 an hour. And as soon as I accepted that status of life, the miracles began to happen. I had a second sobriety date in September, and that's when I got on my knees. Before that, I was too proud, and I thought it was ridiculous. This time, I had been blessed with a willingness to do the things that were suggested. And I started on my knees in September. And to this day, I have not had a drink since September the 18th of that year. And by mid-fall, I began to get a little bit of self-respect back. I looked in the newspaper, found a want ad for an oil company out in West Texas. And I had a resume that read like a dream, except for those 3 years of self-employment that every alcoholic has. So I answered that want ad, and I was hired immediately. And this man said, "Well, with $25,000 be sufficient?" And, you know, from $1.68 an hour, I think so, you know. went to Midland, Texas, of all places, and glad to be back there, and started to work for this oil company. Scared to death, though. I want to laugh with you and enjoy the humor of it, but I also don't want to overlook the terror that was in my heart. For one thing, he said, "Now, when you get here, we'll have a company car waiting for you." Hell, I still had 2 years to go without a driver's license. But I remembered the number. So when I got out there, I filled in the papers and put down that driver's license number, and they handed me the keys. I want you to know, the next 2 years, I was the best driver in the state of Texas. I've never been that good since. But I started going to AA club there, a group, immediately. And there were several old people that just took me under their wing. I was loved into sobriety, and you know what I mean by that. The group just welcomed me. I'd go by there at noon. I'd take a sandwich and eat. I'd go by there at 5 o'clock for the 5 o'clock sales, come back at 8 o'clock for the meeting. And I just lived on AA, and that was my lifeblood. And I began to love the program. And once I got over the fear of being called on, I'll never forget when I was still in Dallas. I was sitting on the back row where I always sat with Pete, and it was a pretty large AA group. And I said, "Pete, I hope they don't call on me." He said, "Don't worry, they won't." "Why?" He said, "Because we want to hear about sobriety from the podium, and they won't call on anybody till they have at least a year of sobriety, so you're not under any threat." Well, A few weeks later, I had seen Father Martin's chalk talk. I don't know if you've seen that on the blackboard. And I asked Pete, I said, Pete, when I am ready and to give my talk, do you suppose we can get a chalkboard up there? He probably saw all this coming. He said, well, I think we have one in the back room. Why would you want that? And I said, well, I've seen Father Martin explaining the chemical formula of the difference between ether and alcohol, and I think I can explain that. I understand it. And so that's about how sick I was, just a real sicko. But I got to West Texas and started staying sober one day at a time, and about the time I had 6 months of sobriety and got my 6 months chip, the sheriff called me and said, Herb, we've got a felony warrant for your arrest out of Dallas. You want to come down and pick it up, or we're going to have to come get you? And I said, Dallas, that can't be me. I've been sober for 6 months. I thought I was bulletproof. And I went, and it was for me, and it was some of the wreckage of the past I had not cleaned up. And I had to go back to Dallas and get mugged and fingerprinted again in the Dallas County Jail, and those iron doors slamming behind, locking. To this day, I can hear it and feel the cold shivers send down my, because I did not want to go back to jail anymore. And I'm going to fast forward and just simply tell you the good news was that I was able, thanks to the courage that had been given me by people like you, I was able to, when they offered a plea bargain to plead to a misdemeanor theft, I said no. I was a bad drunk, but I'm not a thief, and I'd rather go to trial. So by God, if they didn't work out a restitution where I was able to pay off that debt to society, and in about 18 months, why then it would go away, and it did. And I was relieved of that. During that 6 months period, while I had a felony indictment for grand theft over my head, I want you to know I was elected treasurer of the 710 group in Midland, Texas. I mean, where else can that happen but Alcoholics Anonymous? And another thing of importance happened. Mary Ellen came in and decided she needed the program, and we all fell in love with her. Whew. And of course, her sponsors said, now you guys leave the new girls alone for a year and let them get some sobriety under their belt. And I thought I was doing that, but we were going over to her house and listening to tapes and talking program, and she and I got to be friends. And we were friends for a good while before the chemistry started to work, but when it did, it was kind of quick. And she, that Christmas of 1976, she said yes, and we got married when she had 8 months sobriety in February of 77. And a lot of people said, shook their heads and said, man, that'll never work. Her sponsor resigned, thought it was just hopeless that she married that bad old dope-smoking drunk from Dallas, you know. But we had wonderful sponsorship and wonderful advice, and that was that we don't sponsor each other, and we keep God in the middle of the relationship. And he says, with that, it'll have a chance. And we have been trying to do that and practicing it since that time, and it has worked for us. And we've had 28 marvelous years of marriage. Now, I was repairing those relationships with those four children of mine, and she had her two boys from her first marriage. She left Houston to move to Midland to start her life over with her two little boys. And so we at first thought we were safe with each other because both swore we'd never marry again. And you know what happens there. He's promises made and promises broken. But after we got married, that gave us six children between us. They didn't all live. Two of mine eventually came to live with us. But about 5 years later, her younger sister died an untimely death of breast cancer. She was about 38 or 39. And a year later, her husband died, leaving two little boys. And so at that time, I was working for American Airlines, and I flew down and got the boys and brought them back. And because Mary Ellen and her sister were from Montreal, we were the only logical ones to take those two boys in, and we did gladly. And we adopted those two Jones boys. So now we had Wales children and Deal children and Jones children. And hell, I was like W.C. Fields. I didn't care much for kids or dogs, and suddenly I was up to my ass in both of them. But as you know, parenting is like staying sober, man, is one day at a time, and that's about all you can do. So we had a wonderful time there. Mary Ellen ran a, like a fraternity house. She was telling James this afternoon in the car that our grocery bill at first summer was $800 a month. And we had a side of beef in the freezer. And I don't know how much, 2 gallons of milk a day, wasn't it, honey? It was really, food just disappeared around there. But those eight children are all now grown. Bless their hearts. It doesn't seem to be an alcoholic among them, which is shocking to me. But, you know, you never give up hope on those. But in the meantime, I should give her equal time up here, I'll tell you. I was going to that 710 group, and one of my sponsors out in West Texas, my West Texas sponsor, got me started in sponsored into service. And I went to a district meeting one time and came back to the 710, and at our group conscience meeting, I said, "Hey, who is our GSR?" And the old-timers all turned around and looked at me and pointed and said, "You are." And that was my election. And so I became the GSR, which is General Service Rep, for the group, and started in the service work, and also had started on working on the traditions for a family. Mary Ellen and I were blessed with a set of traditions tailored for a family, and it worked miracles for us. We had a group conscience meeting in our home every Sunday night, and everyone had to attend. There were no excuses not to be there. Everyone had an opportunity to speak, even little Andrew. What was he, 7 then? The youngest was 7. And we raised those kids on the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it just made a marvelous home life for us. And my career began to kind of blossom. I'd been approached by one of the lawyers that I had known in previous times in Midland. And he said, "Herb, I don't know what you're making, but I'll double it because we need a guy with your experience and background in this oil company that we've got over here." And so we were blessed with a lot of money to raise those kids for a while. And then the oil business went bad in the 80s. I went broke the first time, and we survived that. But then the bank went under and failed. And when it did, our loans went to the FDIC, and our house was foreclosed on, and they sold our house on the courthouse steps. And that was when I had about 12 years sobriety. So they had warned me, you know, that AA is not a substitute for life. It gives you the tools to deal with setbacks in life. My mother had come out. Mother had cancer, and Mary Ellen went and moved her from Dallas out to Midland, so she had a suite in our home, and she died about 6 months later, within a week of when Mary Ellen's younger sister died. We had 2 deaths in the family with 6 days apart. So we had our hard, trying times, but still we had the higher power and we had the program. And we started going to church on a regular basis to get those boys founded in Christianity, because we believed in it. We had just been kind of off track for a while. And I might say that today it's one of the highlights of our life. We happen to be Episcopalians, and I don't know if you read the newspaper, but there's trouble in River City as far as Episcopalian church is concerned. But we're strong in ours, and Mary Ellen's been leading a Bible study class for 4 years, and that is strengthening so much the spiritual life that we learned first right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so after I'd served my term as GSR, I was elected DCM. You know, we've got all these acronyms in AA. I was elected district committeeman and served, and then later secretary, and then finally delegate to New York to the General Service Conference. And I have to tell you, that was the highlight of my spiritual life, to go to New York and sit down with 135 people there, all of whom loved the fellowship and were there to serve the fellowship. And it was the most beautiful experience. My first year up there was 1988, and they took us out on a Saturday morning. They took all the delegates out to Stepping Stones in Bedford Hills, Bill and Lois Wilson's home. And Lois was still alive, and I got to sit down on a pink settee with her and talk with her a little bit in her home there, and then go up and see Bill's office and go through the thing. And sadly, when I went back the second year, 1989, Lois had died. She was no longer there. So I think it was such a blessing for me to get to visit with her that last year. And then when I came back from being a delegate, they asked me to serve as area chairman for Northwest Texas area for 2 years, and I did. So I've been active in service work from the time I first was given the gift of sobriety. And the things that I learned in the period of getting sober carry me through to this day. I used to be asked, what's the difference between an alcoholic and a drunk? And I was told that an alcoholic could stop drinking if he would, and a drunk would stop drinking if he could. And that was a pretty good definition that I lived by. I don't recall that I was ever seriously tempted, but on the other hand, I did encounter many of the challenges, the early warning signs about don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, and watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. I think the channel or chapter 11 in the big book ought to be at the beginning, because it describes the life of the alcoholic when he can no longer drink and can no longer not drink. And he's haunted by the four horsemen of the apocalypse: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And that's what haunted me before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. After I was given the gift of sobriety and the love of a God that I didn't know anything about when I came to you people, why, then it was a daily challenge to me to be worthy of that love. And I was told that God loves you just exactly as you are, but he loves you too much to leave you there. And so it's been a series of working the steps. Right now I'm in the middle of working the 12 steps with a group of men that we go through a step study outline, and it's usually a 16-week study group. And it's funny, because I thought I'd taken the fourth and fifth step years ago, and amazingly, it says, be sure and put down those old resentments. Sometimes you'll find that they may not be dead yet. To get sober and lead a sober life, and I certainly had no interest in any of the platitudes that you all were talking about, but I stayed because they said, if you will just keep coming, the miracle will overtake you, if you'll just stay until the miracle happens. So I stayed, and to this day, I'm honored to sit down with people like you in different parts of the country and share. And if anything that I say can be of help to anyone, or an inspiration, or shed a bit of light, then I feel like it will have been a worthwhile trip, because I have never been treated better and with greater friendship and hospitality than we have here on this trip. And I'd like to close with something I heard Johnny Harris say years ago down in Florida. He said, I pray that Alcoholics Anonymous will forever remain a haven for the suffering and never become a showplace for the contented. So with that, I'll take my leave, and I thank you again for the pleasure and the honor of being here.